This is Kenneth Banghart reporting from New York and suggesting you switch from Hots to Cool cigarettes for a fresh new experience in smoking enjoyment. Because Cools give you a clean, cool taste in your mouth. Make your throat feel smooth, refreshed all day long. Coming up, early returns from Illinois, a prediction by Kefauver, a short meeting, In Touch by Radio, a man with a list, the story of the long, long ride. And here's a story about a promise. A promise that I can safely make to all you cigarette smokers who would like to trade that smoked-out feeling for a clean, cool taste in your mouth all day long. And the promise is this. Switch from hot cigarettes to Cools, and you'll discover a whole new world of smoking pleasure. Why? Because Cools leave your throat feeling smooth and refreshed hour after hour. And Cools leave your mouth feeling clean and cool the way no other cigarette on earth can do. So if your throat feels raspy, if your regular cigarette leaves your mouth with a dry, fuzzy taste, and your throat feeling raspy and rough, join the millions of smokers who have switched from Hots to Cools. Get Cools tomorrow.
Raspy throat can spoil your fun. Here's advice if you have one. Switch from Hots to
Cools. As Willie the Penguin says, smoke
Cools.
Smoke
Cools.
King size or regular.
And now the news. The latest returns from the Illinois primaries. In the Republican primary, no serious opposition to Eisenhower. First returns from light voting show the president trailing Democrat Stephenson in total votes cast. In the Democratic primary, 821 precincts reporting out of 9,500 give Stephenson, unopposed on that ballot, 84,000 votes. Write-ins for Kefauver generally will be late in tabulation, so it's too early to see what he might receive. Stephenson left by plane for Florida to campaign for support in next month's primaries there. Kefauver, after 5 days of campaigning in New Jersey, where primaries are a week away, has flatly predicted nomination by the Democratic Convention. London, disarmament talks between East and West going on 3 years now, today had their shortest meeting, half an hour. Russia still refusing concessions to Western proposals. Note for Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. Army Specialist Walter Hamannick of Wilkes-Barre today won top prize in the Army's anti-cussing campaign in West Germany. He gets a vacation in Holland for his slogan, Clean Language is a Clean Man. After a brief stop at the port of Algeciras in Spain, the American liner Constitution continues toward the harbor of Monaco, where Grace Kelly Thursday transfers to Prince Rainier's yacht. They say she's in continual touch with him by radio. Moscow Radio says the Russian expedition to the Antarctic has begun radio telephone communication with Moscow. Albany, New York. Governor Harriman, over Vermont protests, today signed a bill making the sugar maple New York State's official tree. It's been Vermont's official tree for some years. Editor of the London menswear journal Taylor & Cutter, John Taylor, today issued his list of the 11 best-dressed men. At the top, Britain's 7-year-old Prince Charles, included Russian Premier Bulganin, due in Britain next week for a visit. As number 11 on his list, Editor Taylor places himself. Washington, an administration source says President Eisenhower is sold, as he puts it, on a new civil rights program against racial discrimination. Late in the day, the Marine drill sergeant, who led a night march into South Carolina swampland in the interest of a platoon's discipline, went before a Marine court of inquiry into the drowning of 6 recruits in treacherous waters. Tonight in Cairo, UN Secretary General Hammarskjöld went into his first talks with Egyptian officials on ways of ending border fighting with Israel. Tomorrow, he sees Premier Nasser. And these last lines. In Newcastle-on-Tyne, England, you could buy season tickets on the local bus, no limit to rides. Those tickets were abolished today, and the great protest from young couples. Sweethearts could not be denied their right to be side by side. 'Twas very gay not having to pay, and to ride, and to ride, and to ride. This is Kenneth Banghart suggesting you switch from Hots to Cools for that smooth, refreshed feeling in your throat, that clean, cool taste in your mouth. Buy Cools, king size or regular. Goodbye, everyone.
Chet Huntley reports the later news tonight on NBC Radio. Another visit with Dr. Margaret Mead, who discusses adolescence in primitive and modern societies. And tomorrow's special guests include John Wayne and Nanette Fabre. Be sure to hear it all tomorrow on NBC's Weekday. And now, stay tuned for Biographies in Sound on NBC.
Baseball has been my whole life, and I wouldn't know what to do if I wasn't in the harness.
is Biography in Sound, another in the prize-winning series of NBC's transcribed biographies of beloved personalities. Tonight, Mr. Baseball, the story of Connie Mack, told by those who knew him, worked with him, and loved him. And here is our narrator, NBC's Assistant Director of Sports, Lindsay Nelson.
Exactly 1 week from today, the players on 16 Major League Baseball clubs will begin a struggle that will last until October. On sun-baked diamonds, young men will lunge for sinking line drives or try to time a change of pace or execute that most graceful of all, the ballet-like movements that sport has to offer, the double play. Batters will experiment with their stances and pitchers with their moves to first. Third basemen will creep toward the plate, suspecting bunts. Umpires will turn their majestic backs on angry players protesting call third strikes. And as the pennant races grow tighter, men with broken fingers or taped ribs will take their places on the field. Players will snarl or smile according to their dispositions, but even those who smile will be deadly serious, for all of them are part of a drama. The drama of the big league pennant race. The drama of baseball. The drama will offer the same thrills this year that it has offered for so many decades. But for some of us who remember Grove and Cochran and Fox, or for the older ones who remember Collins and Barry and Baker and McInnes, there has been a significant change in the drama of baseball. Red Smith, columnist of the New York Herald Tribune, puts it obliquely.
Today there's Connie Mack Stadium in Philadelphia, and the Phillies play there. A National League team. And there's Connie Mack Field in West Palm Beach, and that's the training grounds of the Kansas City Athletics.
To put it most succinctly, this year there will be no Connie Mack. Mr. Baseball, they called him, this tall ramrod of a man with the high collar and the scorecard with which he waved his outfielders around. He died between last season and this season. Connie Mack.
The real name was Cornelius McGillicuddy, and it was cut down so that the newspaper boys would have a chance to get it in once in a while.
He was born Cornelius McGillicuddy on December 23, 1862, in East Brookfield, Massachusetts. In 1883, he was working in a shoe factory to support his widowed mother, but he was playing baseball, too. He was the catcher on the East Brookfield town team. And when that team won the championship of Central Massachusetts, the Meriden Professional Baseball Club signed him. He went from Meriden to Hartford, and then to Washington in 1886. And this was so long ago that Washington was in the National League. It was so long ago that baseball players were by no means national heroes. In fact, as Red Smith tells us, they were not quite respectable.
The picture of what baseball was in those days becomes a little clear, used to become a little clear, when Connie would tell of his first spring training trip to the South. He said the manager took us to the first-class hotel in town, and we were turned away. So he took us to the second-class hotel in town, and we were turned away. We went to the third-class hotel, just a scratch house, and we were admitted there on condition that we didn't mingle with the other guests.
That situation was one that Connie Mack himself helped to change, partly because of his own fine deportment, and partly because, as a manager and owner, he went after ball players wherever he could find good ones. He apparently did not subscribe to the cult of the roughneck. If a man was a good ball player, Connie Mack wanted him, even if the man was respectable. Andy Coakley, one of Connie Mack's early players, bears witness.
He was one of the first managers to take college ball players. Our pitching staff, while I was with them from 1902 to 1906, had Chief Bender and Eddie Plank, Jack Combs, and Weldon Henley, all college men.
But that is getting ahead of our story, because Andy Coakley and those others did not come along until the turn of the century. And by the turn of the century, Connie Mack already had a full Major League career behind him. No one realized at the time that he had several full Major League careers ahead of him, too. His playing career was over, though, and there is no one left to testify as to just what kind of a player he was. But yellowed newspaper clippings and the memory of old-timers about what they heard in their youth from those who were then old-timers give us the picture of a wily, energetic, smart catcher who knew and understood pitchers. He had the reputation of being not a great hitter, but the kind of hitter who got most of his hits when there were men on base. In 1894, after 8 years with Washington, he went to Pittsburgh as manager. Note that year, 1894. He managed a baseball team in the major leagues every year from 1894 until he quit after the season of 1950. From Pittsburgh, he went to manage Milwaukee. And then, well, that brings us back to Andy Coakley.
I can always remember one conversation I had with him. He was telling me about how he happened to get the Athletics in 1901, that everything that he had and everything that he could hawk, he did hawk to buy the club.
And when Connie Mack did acquire the Athletics, which he always called the Athletics, he acquired what turned out to be almost, but not quite, a lifetime job. He was the owner, and he was the general manager, and he was the field manager. The field manager of many a big league ball club has discovered that the owner or the general manager is rather quick to reward an unsuccessful season with a one-way ticket to oblivion. Connie Mack and his Athletics spent a number of years in the baseball cellar and a number of years in seventh place. But Connie Mack never fired Connie Mack. Connie Mack always remembered that his manager had won 9 American League pennants and 5 world championships. He managed the Philadelphia Athletics for half a century, from the era of the mustachioed, tobacco-chewing ball player to the era of the bonus player. In 1948, when he was 86 years old, Mr. Mack, in a tantrum, fired a pitcher he suspected of not trying hard enough. Perhaps the old manager was thinking, when he did so, of what it had been like in the old days. For example, in 1902, when Andy Coakley joined the A's.
I remember, unlike the pitchers today, I got off the sleeper in Philadelphia and pitched that day, the first game I pitched in the big league.
Nowadays, the World Series seems to all of us to have been with us since Columbus. But the man we're talking about, who died only 2 months ago, managed the losing team in the first official World Series. Christy Mathewson of John McGraw's Giants shut the A's out 3 times, and Chief Bender of Connie Mack's A's shut the Giants out once. That same Andy Coakley, whom we've been listening to, pitched and lost one of those games. There was greater glory ahead for both McGraw and Connie Mack, and for Mack, some of that glory started the day he discovered an eccentric left-handed pitcher named Rube Waddell. Red Smith knows that story.
I forgot many of the details, but I remember that the first time Connie got Rube Waddell, he went to the village of Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, to hire him himself. And Rube said that he couldn't join him. He owed too much money in the town. So Connie took him down the main street of the town, and Rube led him into one place after another where he owed a few dollars. Actually, it was just a few dollars. I suppose a couple of $100 or less bought Waddell out of Punxsutawney, but Connie stopped in each place with him and paid off Rube's debts. And he had been quite a pitching hero in the town. And when they got to the railroad station to take the train to Philadelphia or wherever the club was playing at the time, there was quite a delegation of townspeople there. And Connie thought, this fellow's a little hard to handle anyway. He seems reluctant to leave town. Now it looks as though this crowd is going to move in on me and I'm going to be fresh out a great left-handed pitcher. But as they got to the station platform, a spokesman for the crowd stepped up to Connie and formally thanked him for taking Rube out of the town.
Everybody seems to want to talk about Rube Waddell, even such a latter-day star as Mickey Cochran.
He was quite a fellow. Of course, I never knew him, but Mr. Mack used to tell us a lot of stories about him. He loved fire engines, and he loved to tend bar down at Kilroy's Saloon. I think Mr. Mack used to pay him off in $1 bills and hold back part of his salary because Rube would, every Saturday night, take off that saloon, get out of 10 bar for Matt Kilroy.
Any teammate of Waddell's, and sadly there are few of them left, can tell of strange field and dugout behavior on the part of the great left-hander, Andy Coakley, for example.
Rube was pitching a game in Philadelphia. In about the middle of the game, he told Connie he wasn't feelings are good. And he thought if he could have a little drink of brandy that it might pep him up. So Connie sent the trainer into the clubhouse and got him a drink of brandy. And he came out and finished the game, and they couldn't see him. He had so much stuff. But the next game that Rube pitched, he tried the same stunt about the middle of the game. And Connie, wise old Connie, said, he said, you're true. He said, any time that a pitcher has got to have a drink in the middle of a ball game, he says, I don't want him to pitch anymore. So he took Rube out.
That same Andy Coakley, afterwards such a successful coach at Columbia University, apparently had the sharp eye of a good scout even while he was still a player, because it was he who discovered for Connie Mack one of the greatest players of all time.
In 1906, to show how Connie never overlooked a bet on getting a ball player, I was married, and Connie gave me a week off for our honeymoon, and I went up to Vermont. And we took a drive about 20 miles to Montpelier, Vermont, to see a ball game, and Eddie Collins was playing in that game. So he looked pretty good, and I went back, joined the club, and I told Connie about him. Connie sent a bench player up to see him, and he signed him. And that's how Eddie happened to join the Athletics.
And when young Eddie Collins reported to Connie Mack, well, suppose we ask Mrs. Eddie Collins to tell us about that.
Yeah, that's the Sullivan story. Edward was still in college at Columbia, and Mr. Mack sent for him. He apparently had scouted him. And Edward arrived at his office at the ballpark, knocked on the door. Mr. Mack said, come in. Edward opened the door. And Mr. Mack jumped up from behind his desk and said, hello, Sullivan, and dashed out in the corridor with Edward and said, there's a Boston baseball writer in there. And he said, I don't want him to see you. He's probably seen you play against Harvard and Yale and all the other Eastern colleges. So he said, that's why I called you Sullivan. So Edward played that year under the name of Sullivan for Connie Mack. He did not play any home games in Philadelphia when the Red Sox were in town for fear that there would be some Boston newspaper men there who would recognize him.
Eddie Collins, who finally was permitted to use his own name and to play in every game, even in the presence of Bostonians, remained a Major League Baseball player for 25 years, which is a record that will very likely never be broken. Ty Cobb, modestly eliminating himself from the running, calls Collins the greatest of all. He was, in his best days, a fast base runner, a sure-handed, wide-ranging second baseman, and a hitter who consistently was listed in the upper stratosphere of the select 300 list. Connie Mack was proud of Collins, but not only of Collins, for Eddie was a member of an infield that Mack put together, which was surely one of the greatest ever. McInnes, Collins, Barry, and Baker, a great infield. Jack Barry, the shortstop of that combination, remembers one of the pleasures of playing with the other three.
Before the game, we used to put on a practice that people used to come out and see and enjoy before the game started. And we enjoyed it, doing it just as much as the people enjoyed looking at it. And you had to keep your head up, because if we didn't know where the ball was going to be thrown, and if you wasn't watching the ball all the time, you're liable to get hit in the head with it.
And so Connie Mack had a great team, one of the two superb ball clubs he was to put together and manage and win pennants with in his long managerial career. Connie Mack himself once told his opinion as to when that team reached its peak. Red Smith adds a thought or two on the breakup of the 1915 club.
In 14, the Federal League was getting started. It was raiding both the major leagues for players. A number of Connie's players had agreed to play with the Federal League the next year. They were going to get more money than the American League salaries ran in those days. And Connie said that his team was just shot with dissension. Some of his best men were going, and he knew it. Or I should say it was not shot with dissension, but rather shot with dissatisfaction, because some were merely playing out the string in Philadelphia, going to the Federal League the next year, and those who were not going to the Federal League were envious and discontented because they weren't going to get that kind of money. And he just barely held them together to win the pennant in 1914 and I think was not too greatly astonished when they lost the World Series to the Braves in four straight games. After that, he said, there was nothing for it but to break up the team. The Federal League had done a pretty good job of breaking it up for him.
At any rate, the great team had been broken up. And now, for 13 years, from 1915 to 1928, Connie Mack worked on the problem of rebuilding the Athletics. There were long stretches of years, a baseball lifetime for less durable men, when the A's never finished above seventh place. It was sometime during these 13 years that the Connie Mack legend began to grow. It arose partly from the fact that he was already old, as age is reckoned in baseball, but partly also from his respectability. For example, here is Red Smith on the subject of what a young sports writer should call the manager of the Athletics.
I remember that when I first really got to know Connie in Philadelphia, he called me Mr. Smith, and I, of course, called him Mr. Mack. I asked him finally to call me by my first name or my nickname, and he said, all right, you call me Connie. And I said, well, look, Mr. Mack, I can't do that. And he said, all right, I'll call you Mr. Smith. But he broke down, and I didn't, because somehow I never felt old enough to call Connie Connie. You called him Connie in the paper, but he was always Mr. Mack in personal address. Though I noticed that his old ball players, like Al Simmons and Mickey Cochran and Lefty Grove, called him Connie. Those who had known him when he was a mere toddler of 65 or 70. The younger ball players in my day in Philadelphia, the Wayne Amblers and Bill Sissels and Dick Sieberts, called him Mr. Mack.
Of course, there were other names for Mr. Mack besides Mr. Mack, as Mickey Cochran, who came along at the end of the 13-year famine, testifies.
They had a few nicknames for him. Spindly strategist and a tall tactician. But they never said that around him.
But the Mack legend was not confined to intimations of respectability. You don't make a beloved sports page figure out of a completely stuffed shirt. A man must have foibles, and Connie Mack had a very endearing foible. Red Smith again.
Connie's gift for mispronouncing names went way back to the days of Addie Joss, the pitcher whom Connie always referred to as Josh. And his great left-hander with the 1929-30-31 champions in Philadelphia was always Lefty Groves. He added the unnecessary S to old Bob Groves' name. Connie said one time he thought it would be a long time before we saw another double play combination to match Ristu and Gordon. He was speaking, of course, of Phil Rizzuto of the Yankees. He seldom got them entirely right.
And much newsprint was devoted to the stop press intelligence that one Connie Mack, a big league manager and a former player himself, actually did not swear. He didn't even use bad language. That, at least, is what the newspapers said. And America seemed as delightedly prepared to believe this as if it were an item of scandalous gossip. If a great literary man, like Mark Twain, for instance, uses sulfurous language, this makes him a colorful character. Apparently, people felt that if a baseball man spoke quietly and mildly, this made him a colorful character. We have Mr. Mack himself on this subject in answer to a young boy's question.
Mr. Mack, I heard that you were an awful good man, and that whenever you do get mad and swear, the worst thing you say is, my gracious, is that true?
I guess that's pretty near true, because I don't like to hear the swearing. I tell them that swearing never helped any ball player's success.
But on the subject of the apparent sainthood of Connie Mack, we have some testimony from the invaluable Red Smith, who traveled with the A's for 10 years.
Connie, you know, was always painted as a plaster saint. In the newspapers, he was quoted as saying, my goodness, or goodness gracious. And that was the impression, at least, was given that was the strongest expletive he ever used. It was not. Connie had grown up on baseball benches where, you hardly confuse the language with that you might hear in a convent school. And I never saw him blush, either listening to or occasionally borrowing some of that language.
Well, at any rate, the public concept of Mack as an interesting and respectable and lovable old codger came into being. And as I have said, during the stretch between the breakup of the great team in 1915 and the final flowering of that other great team in 1929. You know the team I mean, of course. Remember the names? Cochran, Grove, Earnshaw, Emke, Fox, Dykes, Bishop, Simmons, Boley, Haas, Miller. A great team? Well, Mickey Cochran points out a pretty startling fact.
That was one of the real great clubs of all time. As it eventually developed, there were four players on that team, all elected to the Hall of Fame, all playing on the same team at the same time.
The four players Mickey refers to are Cochran himself, Fox, Grove, and Simmons. But if you think such great teams were assembled without a certain amount of careful tinkering on the part of the manager, consider the fact that Connie Mack experimented with Jimmy Fox at both third base and catcher before he settled on first base as the right position for the brawny Maryland youngster. As for Mickey Cochran, well, let Mickey speak about Connie Mack's early estimate of the man he later named as the greatest catcher of all time.
He didn't think much of me as a catcher, I know, when I first joined the ball club. Seriously, considering making a third baseman out of me. I could run pretty well, and I could hit. Plus, I'd only caught 1 year in the Coast League. But he tried me at third base for a couple of weeks, and my chest gave out, and he decided to put me back at the plate again.
There is, of course, such a thing as raw talent. But it's the manager's job to know how to handle it. Jimmy Fox certainly had talent. With his sturdy body and his powerful wrists and forearms, he was made to be a slugger. Still, he had to be helped. Fox himself tells how Mack helped him.
I think the greatest thing that Mr. Mack did for me, and I believe it's so with most any young fella, he gives you confidence and talks to everyone, explains things. He seldom ever raises his voice. I don't think I ever heard him actually bawl anyone out. And incidentally, if he does bawl you out, he can do it in about five words as well as somebody else can do it in a half hour.
It was in 1929 that Mack's careful rebuilding and his sympathetic handling of his young talent paid the dividend of a pennant. The club had come on well in the final half of the 28th season, losing to the great Ruth Gehrig Yankee team by just 2.5 games. By opening day of 1929, the A's were ready. Throughout the season, they clubbed their opponents into defeat, ending the season with an 18-game margin over the second-place Yankees. In the World Series, the A's played against one of the best of the many fine Chicago Cubs pennant winners. And in that series, according to Red Smith, Connie Mack received his greatest thrill as a manager.
That was the day that the Cubs were leading the Athletics in the World Series, and in, was it the eighth inning, the seventh? At any rate, one of the late innings, the Athletics scored 10 runs and went on to win the ball game easily.
But it was in the first game of that series that Connie Mack's greatest managerial gamble produced results which are still remembered and still talked of. During the year, Howard Emke, who was now nearing the end of his fine career, had been what's called a spot pitcher. That is, he was used only from time to time when other pitchers needed rest or when he himself felt ready. His record was not too wonderful, and yet Connie Mack started him in the first game of the World Series. Like the other players on the club, Mickey Cochran was astonished.
He certainly surprised everybody on the ball club. Emke hadn't pitched a game in 6 weeks. In fact, he sent him home from St. Louis. He got so disgusted with him and said, when you get ready to pitch a ball game, come back and tell me. Well, evidently, Emke told him the night before, and he said, all right, you're pitching. Well, we didn't know it until he started to warm up the next day.
You are listening to Mr. Baseball, tonight's biography in sound. Part two will continue after a 10-second pause for station identification.
Actually, Mickey Cochran did not know the story behind the starting of Emke. It had been agreed on weeks before between the pitcher and Connie Mack. Howard Emke himself tells the story this way.
On the 13th of September, I pitched my last league game, a three-hitter against the Chicago White Sox, and won 3-0. So the next day, Mr. Mack got the idea he would use me against the Cubs because I was a right-handed side-armer. Now, any right-hand hitter hates to hit against a right-handed side-armer. And the Chicago Cubs had 8 right-hand hitters and 1 left-hand hitter. The left-hand hitter was Charlie Grimm, who is now the manager of Milwaukee. So on this particular day, September 14th, Mr. Mack asked me, how about cold weather? And I knew what he was driving at. He meant the World Series. We had practically cinched the pennant. And it was just a question of a few days that it would be all over, and we would be thinking about the World Series. So I said, you mean the opening game of the series? That's what I wanted. I always wanted to pitch one game, and I knew that I could get myself in good shape from the 14th of September to the 8th of October. That would give me 24 days in which to get myself in tip-top shape. And I said, I will take care of the game for you. If I'm not able to pitch, I will tell you, and then, as I understand it, George Earnshaw is the second choice. He said, that's just exactly what I have in mind. And he said, you govern yourself accordingly. He said, you won't have to go with the team on the road. You stay home and train yourself as you see fit. Go to the Phillies ballpark and watch the Cubs play when they come to town. When I come home, we'll have a little chat up in my tower at Scheib Park. And I made these few notes about the Chicago hitters and went to Mr. Mack's office when he returned from the Western trip. And Mr. Mack had already told me not to tell anyone, and I hadn't even told Mrs. Emke. So when I saw him, he said, you haven't told anybody, have you? And I said, no, I haven't mentioned it to anybody, and I won't because those are my instructions. So we went to Chicago after the World Series, or after the last game of the season was over, and we're ready to start on a Tuesday, I believe, with the Chicago Cubs. And nobody expected me to pitch. And I was rooming with Jimmy Fox at the Edgewater Beach Hotel, and that night as we were ready to turn in, Jimmy said to me, he said, Howard, he said, I have an idea. The old gentleman, that was Mr. Mack, will pitch you tomorrow. Oh, I said, jump in bed and go to sleep and forget about it. Well, he said, if you do, he said, I'll hit one for you anyway. Well, we had our good night's sleep, and the next day we had our meeting in the Edgewater Beach Hotel ballroom. And after the players had all left the room, Mr. Mack and Eddie Collins, the captain, always had a little chat about what would happen between then and just before Mr. Mack came to the bench before the game started. So as the last player got out of the ballroom and wouldn't detect that I was there and was going to talk to Mr. Mack, I walked up to Mr. Mack and Mr. Collins and said, does it still go? He said, absolutely. And he said, I'm sure you'll win if you're right. So I said, well, that's all right then. And I said, then Earnshaw is going to be the next choice if I'm not right. And he said, that's correct. So we went to the ballpark, and it was a cold, windy day. And I stayed in the clubhouse. Earnshaw and Grover both to stay in the clubhouse at the same time to keep warm. But about 20 minutes before the game started, both Earnshaw and Grove slipped out, and they went down on the bench. I remained until about 10 minutes of starting time, and then went down. I picked up a ball out of the ball bag, and so I warmed up, and I was in perfect shape, had perfect control, good speed, good curve. And the game was to start at 1:30, but it was held up and to allow all the fans to get seated. And during that time, from 1:30 to quarter of 2, the Chicago pitcher was out on the mound tossing a few balls to keep warmed up, and the two coaches or captains were at home plate going over the ground rules with the umpires. And I didn't know that the game had been held up those 15 minutes. So I had those 15 minutes plus the 15 or 20 minutes for the first half inning to be over. And during that time, I got cooled off. So when I walked out to the mound, I had to practically warm up again. And it took me about 2 innings before I was actually ready. And from the beginning of the, I got into a little trouble in the first and second innings, but I got out of them all right. And from the beginning of the third to the close of the seventh, out of 15 men to face me, I struck out 12 of them. Well, that tied the World Series record for strikeouts. So the score was nothing to nothing, and it was Fox's turn to come to bat to open the first half of the seventh. And when he walked over to the bat, Rack, he picked up a bat and looked in at me and smiled as much as to say, well, here's my promise. And he walked up to the plate and he did exactly, well, he didn't point the same as Babe Ruth did to where he was going to hit the ball, but he hit the ball in the same position that Babe did, in the center field bleachers. That gave us a 1-0 lead until we came down to the 9th inning. Well, we had picked up 2 more runs in the first half of the 9th to give us a 3-0 lead, and that was surely enough for any pitcher to win on. But in the 9th inning, I got into a little trouble. The first batter hit a ball back to me, and I knocked it down and threw him out at first base. And then the next batter hit a ground ball to Dykes, who made a very bad throw at first base, and the runner went on to second. Well, then things happened, and happened fast. The next 2 batters got scratch hits and scored 1 run. That left the man on third base and the man on first, and 1 man out. The next batter was a force out, and then the next batter came up. He was a pinch hitter by the name of Tolson. And I got the count down to 2-2 on him, and I pitched a ball through there for a perfect strike. And umpire Billy Clem had umpired a beautiful ball game up to this point, and this was no time to be fooling around and missing a strike when the ball game would be over. But he called it a ball, and it made the count 3-2. So oftentimes you'll see pitchers congregate between home plate and pitcher's box, and you wonder what they're talking about. Well, I'll assure you that we weren't fooling that day, because there were $60,000 at stake, and we wanted the larger end of it. So I told Cochran just exactly what I wanted him to do, and this is it. I said, now you go back and we'll let this fella stand in the batter's box there just as long as we can, and the longer he stands, the worse he's going to get, more nervous. So, and then you get down, give me a sign, and we'll still make him wait, and I'll stand in the pitcher's box like holding a runner on first base, and I'm going to shake my head no and pitch. And the pitch is going to be a fastball. Well, when a batter is up there hitting, he usually guesses what you are going to throw. And if he guesses what you're going to throw, it's a little bit tough for the pitcher. But this was the story. I was to shake my head no and pitch immediately so as not to give him a chance for a second guess. And when the ball was on the way to the plate, Cochran was to yell out as loud as he could, hit it. Well, everything worked along nicely and came right down to the pitch. I shook my head, and Cochran yelled, hit it. And the man struck at the ball. It was Clyde Tolson, I believe his first name was Clyde. Struck at the ball and missed it, and the game was over. And that was the World Series record for strikeouts.
It was, of course, a daring move, starting Emke in that series. But it was the kind of daring move made by a tactician who knows exactly what he's doing. The following spring, Connie Mack made another daring move, and again, he knew what he was doing. Mickey Cochran was there, and he knows.
Well, I remember 1930, and of course we won the pennant in 29 by a big margin, and we couldn't beat anybody in spring training. Even the House of David beat us 8-0. Everybody had the idea of, well, wait till the bell rings, and we'll get going. So smart a psychologist Mr. Mack was, he said, I'm sick of looking at this ball club. I'm going back to Philadelphia. And back he went, and then he gave out a big story to the paper that it was the worst-looking ball club he'd managed in 25 years. Well, that kind of burned up the ball club. It woke him up, and we stepped out, and I think we won 75 out of the first 100 games we played.
One of Connie Mack's fine achievements as a manager was his handling of Robert Moses Lefty Grove. As an old catcher, Mack knew pitchers. Red Smith is able to give us his estimate of Grove.
Of Lefty Grove, he said that in his first years as a pitcher, with such a great fastball, Grove was strictly a thrower. That it wasn't until Bob hurt his arm that he developed into a genuine major league pitcher of great canniness on the mound. Connie said it was hard to believe, but after he hurt his arm, he seemed to know on what pitch the batter was going to swing. And that was the time he didn't give him anything good to hit, of course. But Grove a thrower like most wild, strong young guys at the beginning, and a really wise, smartened-up pitcher once his arm made him use his brain.
Cochran, Grove, Fox, Simmons, and the rest, one of the great teams of all time. They won pennants in 1929, 1930, 1931. But just as Mac had broken up his 1915 team, so did he now start to break up this one. He once told about this.
I began to break them up in 1932. Once again, it was hard, but I had to do it. Every man was a star, and the budget of our club couldn't pay their salaries. And again, I had to start from scratch and build a complete new team.
And once again, Red Smith can tell us more about the breakup of that team.
He spent a great deal of money building that team, and it was a great team, and again he broke that one up. This time there was no Federal League to break it up. The Cardinals, I think, helped considerably in 1931 by beating the Athletics in the World Series after Philadelphia had won in 1929 and 1930. And I think Connie felt that that was the first chink in the armor. This was the time now to rebuild or to change. Also, this time, there was a very definite decline in income and rise in expenses, and he had to do something to stay sound, so he began to sell off players. And down he went again. It was always a long haul. It's a desperately long haul. If you just lose a regular major league shortstop, it may take you many years to come back. When you sell off virtually a whole team, it's going to be a long, trying time before you get back.
It is important to remember that when Connie Mack set out in 1932 to break up a pennant winner, he was 70 years old, yet he still had ahead of him 18 more years as a baseball manager. By this time, however, he had garnered more experience than anyone else ever has. Already, he was Mr. Baseball. The years of decline and of futile striving lay ahead. We shall look at those years in a moment. But it might be well first for us to gather together a series of impressions which will possibly add up to an implicit estimate of the baseball phenomenon that was called Connie Mack. He could always explain why he did something.
Mr. Mack, why do you always wave a scorecard from the dugout in the ball game?
Well, the favorite scorecard is, you know, is we use that scorecard for the privilege of telling our outfielders and our infielders just where to move. It all depends on the pitcher, you know. If you know your pitcher awful well, you can just move that outfield just about where that batter's going to hit that ball. And you can also move that infielder just about where that batter's going to hit that ball. But you've got to know the pitcher.
Even early in his managerial career, he knew how to handle his players. Jack Barry tells how Connie Mack handled him when he joined the Athletics in 1908.
He told me that he wasn't going to play me all season, that I was going to sit on the bench and watch the games. Incidentally, I never saw a big league game until I went into Philadelphia to play. I was there two or three days, and he put me in to run for somebody. And after the game, the next day, he put me into play. And he could see that I was a little nervous. So the following day, he took me out. And the day following that, he put me back in again, and I stayed in for the rest of the time.
And the great Jimmy Fox learned a lesson from Mac.
When I first joined Mr. Mac, one of the players got an argument with the umpire and was eventually thrown out of the game. And when he came over to start down to the clubhouse, we had a walkway there, Mr. Mack called him over, and one of the few times you hear him ball someone out. And he kind of gave him a going over and told him it's perfectly all right to argue when you think you're right, but there's also a time to stop. And said, don't ever let me see you get thrown out of a ball game again, because I want you to know that you're of no value to me whatsoever in the clubhouse. And that always stuck in my mind, and incidentally, I got by without being thrown out of one.
And Mickey Cochran once again.
He was a great student of pitchers. And I think that was one of the main reasons of his success, because being an old catcher, he had a chance to study every type of pitcher, and he did a real job in handling a pitching staff.
And even in his younger days, Connie Mack was considerate of his players, as witness what Jack Barry says.
Now, if he had to call a player down, he never did it in public. He'd always take him one side and then tell him what he thought. And that would be the end of the argument.
One of the most difficult tasks of a manager is to tell a player he is through or that he's being sold. How Connie Mack handled such situations may be made clear by citing three cases. First, Jack Barry.
When he sold me to the Red Sox, he told me that the reason he had to do it was because he lost money. But he said that the Chicago White Sox and the Yankees wanted me also, but he knew I'd be better satisfied to play with nearer home with the Red Sox, and he said he sacrificed some money in doing so, which I thought was very nice of him.
Second, the end of the trail for the great Eddie Collins, as Mrs. Collins tells it.
Well, it was toward the end of Edward's active playing career, and he was slowing up a bit, I suppose. And Mr. Mack called him one day, and he said, you know, we have quite a problem at third base coaching. He said, we're losing a lot of ball games there. How would you feel about taking over that position? Edward laughed to him, and he said, well, Mr. Mack, if you think I'm slowing up, well, I'll do any place that'll do the team any good.
And finally, Mickey Cochran.
Well, I was the last one to go, and he said, well, he wouldn't consider letting me go unless I had the chance to manage along with it.
On the other hand, when a player had to negotiate his salary with Connie Mack, he discovered that Mr. Mack could be considerate of himself, too. He was, it must be remembered, not one of the wealthy owners in baseball, and his teams did not usually make much money. Consequently, well, let Mickey Cochran tell how it felt to try to trade horses with Connie Mack.
Well, he was pretty rough, I'll have to admit that. Oh, I held out once, but it didn't do me any good. You were mentioning going over that bridge of size up to his tower up there in the Shibe Park, and we always call it the bridge of size. We'd go over there and go in like a lion and come out like a lamb.
Or, as Jimmy Fox laconically puts it,
well, I wouldn't say that he particularly was tight with a dollar. But I might add also that it was awfully hard to get more than a dollar out of him.
A player's wife sometimes has a very special slant on a manager. Mrs. Eddie Collins tells what sort of a man she thought Connie Mack was.
Connie Mack was a very kind man. He was always glad to see you, and he was friendly. He was always interested in the children, what had happened since the last time he'd seen them. And I'm sure the wives thought just as much of Connie Mack as their husbands who played for him.
And of course, as Connie Mack himself said, baseball was his life. The infinite variety of it fascinated him. He told Jimmy Fox once what he thought of baseball.
One of the funny things I might say, after all the years that he'd put in, was just a few years before he passed on, I heard him tell a fellow, well, said, you know, baseball's quite a game. You always learn something new. That I haven't learned it all yet.
We come now to the last years of Connie Mack as a manager. The 18 years from the time when he broke up the last of his great teams in 1932 until he managed his last game in 1950. 57 years after he had first signed as a big league manager. The record of his striving is written in the list of his trades, the list of the players he bought or sold, and most revealingly, in the statements he made early each season. In 1937, for example,
I have some splendid youngsters on the team now. They're full of fight and full of promise, and I'm hoping for the best. Of course, the Yankees look strong for us this year, but there's always next year.
Next year came and went, and again in 1939.
I am in hopes the Athletics will make a fair showing this year due to this being centennial year. I know that our club is a greatly improved one over last year.
And in 1942, 10 years after he had put his great stars up for sale, Connie Mack was still hoping for one more great team.
We lost 12 good men to the Army. We'll be better next year. In fact, I think we'll finish in the first division.
And just before his 57th and final year as a big league manager, he was still gallantly hoping and able now wistfully to laugh a little at his own hopes.
You know, we have four great clubs. They're the Boston, the Yankees, and Cleveland, and Detroit. And I'm not going to say who is going to win the championship. I'm just hoping that the Philadelphia Athletics will win the pennant this year.
Well,
Red Smith sums up those last years of manager Connie Mack.
He used to be quoted to the effect that he wanted to stay in baseball until he had won one more pennant. He always denied that. He said he wanted to stay in baseball until he had been in the race once more. He didn't insist that he win, only that he have a chance to win, be up there in the pennant battle. And they really never were in his last days, though there were a few years when they showed what the chart caller at the races called a flash of speed, early in the year, sometimes late. They never got there, though.
When Connie Mack finally resigned as manager of the Athletics in 1950, he remained, of course, as owner. But the franchise was no longer what it had been. For some time, it had been apparent that Philadelphia was no longer a two-club city. You can blame Philadelphians for this if you want, but it's more sensible to blame the increased cost of running a Major League Baseball club. No club can get along on the kind of attendance which once might have made many an owner happy. Boston has become a one-league city in St. Louis and Philadelphia. After the season of 1954, the Athletics were sold to Arnold Johnson, who moved the franchise to Kansas City.
From the date of the sale of the A's, Connie Mack Sr.'s cooperation was magnificent. He became honorary chairman of the board of the club and was the leading guest at the opening game of the season in Kansas City. Kansas City and the Missouri Valley crowds greeted him with open arms as he appeared on the field at the new stadium. His reception was simply terrific and will long be remembered by the people of the Missouri Valley.
One of Connie Mack's old stars met Connie Mack, who had come to watch the Athletics in Kansas City. Jack Barry.
Last time I saw Mr. Mack was last July, 20th of July, out in Kansas City. I was selected on an all-star athletic team and invited out there, and Connie was there. But the poor man had failed considerably since I had seen him before. In fact, when I went and spoke to him, I told him who I was, and he was glad to see me. And then the next day, Bing Miller told me that Connie said to him that afternoon that he was sorry he didn't recognize me.
Perhaps a paragraph from a factual newspaper account of Connie Mack's death in February tells the unhappy truth. He had been in failing health, says that paragraph, since the Athletics were sold 15 months ago and transferred to Kansas City. But probably few people like to think of Connie Mack as he was at the very end. They like to remember him as Ford Frick, Commissioner of Baseball, does.
I knew him as a power in baseball. And believe me, he was a power in baseball. He was respected by everyone because back of everything he said, everything he suggested, everything he stood for, we knew was, first of all, sincerity and honesty. And beyond that, experience and good judgment. I suppose there was no man in baseball through his strong years who had greater impact on the game than Mr. Mack. Not because he threw his weight around too much. He wasn't that type of person. He wasn't the sort of a person who delivered long orations and made great speeches in league meetings. Mr. Mack, I still remember him sitting back and listening to everything that had been said, listening to arguments pro and con, never saying a word. Then finally, when it was all done, someone would turn to Mr. Mack in his quiet way, and in very few words, he would say what he thought and what he believed. And the strange part of it was that 9 times out of 10, what Mr. Mack said was what occurred. As you can gather, I had great respect for Mr. Mack.
Will Harridge, the president of the American League, has this to say about Connie Mack.
I remember one little episode I witnessed a few years ago when Mr. Mack was with his beloved Athletics at West Palm Beach during spring training. An elderly man and his wife called out from the bleachers to Mr. Mack, asking for his autograph. As they started down the bleacher steps, Mr. Mack motioned them to wait. "I'll come up to you, please." He did so, and he was then well over 85. As he returned sprightly to the field, he received a tremendous hand from every fan in the bleachers. He was that kind of a man. I shall always be grateful for having known him as a long life friend and associate, one whose name always will be synonymous with baseball.
One thing is certain. All of us who have been going to the big league ballparks for years will remember the tall, stiff, courteous old gentleman sitting on the hard bench of the dugout, more erect than the young ball player sitting with him, though they could have been his great-grandchildren. Young people yet unborn will hear tales of the man who waved his scorecard until his right fielder moved to a certain spot. And behold, on the very next pitch, the batter's line drive went straight to that outfielder. They will hear that he was tall and skinny and sometimes cantankerous, and that he called for pitch outs and ordered steals and moved his infield back for the double play until he was nearly 90. Maybe they won't believe it, but that man did live. He is the man who said,
"Baseball has been my whole life, and I wouldn't know what to do if I wasn't in the harness."
His name was Cornelius McGillicuddy. His name was Connie Mack. They called him Mr. Baseball.
You've been listening to another in NBC's transcribed prize-winning series of Biographies in Sound. Tonight's biography, narrated by NBC's Assistant Director of Sports, Lindsay Nelson, was Mr. Baseball, the story of Connie Mack. We wish to thank all who generously gave of their time to assist us in preparing this show. Mr. Baseball was written by Robert Senadella and directed by George Voutsos, and is an NBC Radio Network production. Wednesday is airtime with Giselle McKenzie on the NBC Radio Network.